I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to minute 120. Wow, 2 hours of season six of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off his set of five episodes, even though today is Wednesday, is Dean O'Carroll, an award-winning playwright. So welcome back to the show, Dean. You don't seem to like that. I don't know why.
Oh, well, it's so funny. I mean, I have won an award or two, but it was like a goofy award from friends in college and so on, which is still up on my shelf. But
do you want me to rephrase it and say and winner of goofy awards?
I'm an award-worthy playwright.
Okay, award-worthy is good, too.
Yeah, I'm honored to be here as we not only do we cross the 2 hour mark with this movie, but we also get to hear more or less the title of it in this minute.
That is correct.
And this is pretty long for a movie of this time. I mean, you know, obviously there were some epic movies.
No, there's a lot of movies that are much longer. I mean, come on, yeah, just look at Best Years of Our Lives, which came out in the same year. Best Years of Our Lives is 2 hours and 42 minutes or something like that. I mean, that's a big difference.
Okay, all right. Not true. Okay, but there were a lot of movies that really just clipped along, like particularly the comedies of that era.
Comedies, but when you're dealing with
minutes, yeah.
That's right. That's correct.
Yeah.
So minute 120 begins with Clarence blaming or accusing George of Harry's death, and ends with George finally seeing Mary.
So right.
So Clarence got cut off yesterday at the end of the minute because he basically said, you know, because you weren't there to save Harry is how this minute begins, you know, so it's somewhat accusing, basically saying, okay, the fact that you've chosen that you don't want to be alive, you caused the death of everyone on that transport because you weren't there to save Harry, you know, the butterfly effect or whatever you want to call it, you know, as you're going through the, you know, with the, everything that's happening in this new reality.
You know, I've never thought of it before, but you do kind of have to wonder. So when Clarence asks Joseph to do this and he does this, is there any chance that this could just be the new reality that we wouldn't go back at the end? I mean, I've always assumed this was just, here's a glimpse at what it would have been like that, you know, so maybe actually it is all just, you know, hallucination. Maybe they are, if you want to get real knee deep in this, maybe they are transported to an alternate reality or whatever. But I suddenly had the thought, like, wow, what if by some bizarre mistake, George liked it better this way and just wanted to settle into this world. I guess I've seen parodies of It's a Wonderful Life that do things like that, of the world is better this way. Was there any chance that we weren't going to revert back to the primality at some point and those, you know, hundreds or thousands of servicemen would be dead? Yikes.
Well, as I mentioned yesterday, it means that there's no other pilot that could have done what Harry did, you know. The guy who would have taken his place.
Stepped up.
You know. Yeah, I don't know. And then Clarence says to him, you see, George, you've really had a wonderful life. Don't you see what a mistake it would be to throw it away? So, I mean, I think that this is a great comment by Clarence, but I don't think it's at the right time. You know, as you just said, he's basically saying, okay, there are all these dead servicemen because of you. So you've had a wonderful life.
Maybe we need to think of the word wonderful a little bit more deeply, because we use wonderful just to mean really good, which of course does apply here, but maybe we need to think that literally he had a life full of wonders, that, you know, that he did things that caused wondrous things to happen, cause actual, miraculous supremely beneficial things to happen, that, you know, that he didn't just have a good life. He didn't just live life as a good man. He caused wonders. Maybe that's overthinking.
Again, going back to the example with the transport, that has nothing to do with George. You know, George doesn't cause that wonder to happen. You know, the fact that George saved Harry, so the chain reaction helped Harry make that wonder. But George didn't make that wonder. I mean, obviously, you know, there's it's never ending talking about the various connections that a person has in their life, because you touch a person who touches a person, and they eventually, you know, can do something. And you might have a very small part in helping that happen, but you're not necessarily going to be doing it actively, or you know, it's going to be more of a passive action. You know, so is George, you know, George passively helped Harry save the men on the transport? I mean, that's a little stretch also, but yeah, that's what they're trying to say here. But again, you would expect him to say this phrase at a more opportune time. I don't know if this is the greatest time. I mean, George is sitting there clearing off all of the fake snow from the tombstone at the time.
Yeah. And I mean, it couldn't be earlier, I don't think. And if it was any later, because this is pretty much George's last interaction with Clarence, right? He runs off to find Mary, then escapes from that, and he goes back to the bridge.
Right.
And doesn't really see Clarence again, right?
I don't believe so.
Right. So the only thing, if Clarence had then appeared at the bridge again and they had this talk then, would that
No, but work? at that point he already wants, you know,
yeah,
to
Yeah, that's true.
To,
yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I see your point, but I'm not sure if I can think of any other place to put it.
Correct. That's the issue here. You know, on the one hand,
they would have to have that talk after he sees Mary, like sort of, but before he gets to the bridge.
Right.
Which at that point, he probably already really has decided. So it's, I think probably was the best choice available. I'm suddenly reminded of a series of books that I loved when I was a kid, by an author named David Eddings. He had a few different series set in the same fantasy world. He was Sword and Sorcery novels. Mm-hmm. The first series
I'm familiar
called,
with them.
Okay. Yeah. It's very standard stuff, very enjoyable. But there's a prophecy at the heart of it, and the characters. The first book in the series is called Pawn of Prophecy, and at one point, one character needs to give an inspiring speech to sort of drum up the troops, and she's afraid to do it. And then one drunk guy in the audience starts sort of heckling her. And that sort of, you know, inspires her, gets her angry enough that she does, you know, give the inspiring speech to drum everybody up. And then later on, one of the magical characters were like, you know, that was probably the only reason that young man was born, to get drunk on this day and annoy you to get going. And it's like, oh, that's an interesting idea, that in a world of sort of prophecy and fate, that characters would have roles like that. You know, that's the only reason that they would be born. You know, clearly, this is not the only reason George was born, to save Harry, so Harry could save those people. But it was, you know, on a short, pure number standpoint, probably the most important.
Right. But again, it goes back to what we were saying about the passive connections that one makes, as opposed to, you know, and then there is the ripple effect, butterfly effect, chain reaction, whichever you want to call it, of everything happening to other people based on the events of, you know, of the actions of George or any other character. You know, it goes along with the, you know, 6 degrees of Seven Bacon, of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, not Seven Bacon. You know, that whole idea. You know, that one person can be connected to others.
Do you think the movie would have been improved or just as good if we didn't have that as an aspect? If we didn't have Harry saving a troop transport?
No, I think it's something that's very important, because it's showing that, okay, you know, you not being around will affect the fact that Harry's not around. even though you think that if you're not around, everything will be hunky dory, everything will be great. You know, you look at what happened to your mother. Look what happened to Martini, who disappeared. Apparently, you know, he never got his dream of bar and building, you know, building his own home. We know what happened to Gower. I mean, all these different things. You know, the fact that George wasn't around to maneuver between them has obviously caused issues. But do I think that they didn't need to have the transport? No, I think they do, because it shows. Again, it's not just everything that George himself does. It's what George does for other people, which then touches the next person, the next person, the next person. Okay. My gripe here is not about the fact that they talk about the transport. My gripe is that why is Clarence saying that right after? Why is Clarence saying you've had a wonderful life after the fact that he's mentioning about the transport not being safe?
Okay, now I see where you're coming from. Okay, I think we're working at slightly cross purposes there for a bit there. Okay, yeah, I think that's very valid. Apropos of almost nothing, I do want to ask about this. It's not relevant to my minutes. Sam Wainwright as a character.
Yes.
If I were to make any changes to this movie, I would probably have Sam Wainwright die in the war, because I don't love at the end when we get the telegram from Sam that he'll, you know, advance George as much money as he needs, because I feel like that invalidates all the little contributions from his friends, you know?
I do agree with you that there is something to that. I don't know if Sam Wainwright should have died during the war, because Sam Wainwright was
just the only way I the only
was
way,
not
I think it's
in combat
earlier on. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. What context would Sam, a possible war profiteer, be involved in actual combat? Yes, but that's the only way. Having him die is the only way I could think to have him completely out of the picture, so he can't be sort of there to bail George out. So he has to get a few bucks here and there from everybody who loves him, and also, you know, I think it would be kind of cool if, you know, cool is a horrible word. Yeah, you know, people die in wars, and we hear how, you know, George's friends served and the valiant things they did, and that's great, and it's wonderful that celebrating that. But, you know, if we'd heard that someone had died, as plenty of people did, I think that would have some power too. So yeah, and this is only something that has occurred to me having seen this movie dozens of times. It would not have and maybe even looking for something to find fault with in my favorite.
Okay, I can hear that, but you know, I think that Sam Wainwright giving the money at the very end doesn't take away from the fact that everyone else is willing to give the money to help him. It's more of a cushion. It's the idea that someone finally was able to get in touch with him because he's traveling around Europe, and you know, you know, getting in touch with someone via cell phone back then was very difficult, if not impossible.
True. Yeah.
because there was
cable no through.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. Yeah. I mean, I have other problems with Sam Wainwright that I came across only by doing this minute by minute. The fact that Sam Wainwright really wasn't interested in dating Mary because he was playing around with some woman at the same exact time.
I do like that Sam isn't like a total jerk. That he's, you know, he's a bit much, and certainly wouldn't have been right for Mary, but I like that he's affable enough in his own way that a cheaper movie would have made him a real jerk.
And, right, that's true.
Yeah.
That's
oh
true.
Boy, now I've got all these other questions that I want to ask about that aren't about my minutes. Like, do you think Bert the cop always has an accordion in his car, or if he just carries it around on Christmas Eve and things like that? But I thought we should stick with that.
It's for him. It's for when he's walking around caroling, isn't it?
Right.
So the answer to that is only on Christmas Eve. There.
Yeah.
And then after Clarence says this to George, I guess has a moment of clarity, and he goes, Clarence. Yes, George, because he's ranting and raving up until now, but now he just says it in a very calm fashion. And he goes, where's Mary? Oh, well, I can't. I don't know how you know these things, but tell me, where is she? If you know where she is, tell me where my wife is. I'm not supposed to tell. You know,
isn't
I guess
that interesting? I'm not supposed to tell. What does that mean?
It's like, you know, figure it out for yourself. I think that's what the idea is.
I guess so, because suddenly there are rules to this. I mean, I guess Clarence has let George figure everything out, right? He hasn't told him anything.
He's let him go wherever he wants to go.
Yeah.
And he goes, please, Clarence. Yeah,
he's only sort of, explained things that George has actually already seen.
That's right.
Yeah, it's interesting that there are rules to this. I mean, clearly there are rules, you know, like you have to earn your wings. I love also that this is Clarence's turn in the rotation again. So he's tried to help people out in the past and failed.
That's right.
So, I don't want to see those prequels of Clarence's failed attempts at preventing people from committing suicide or whatever. Those particular missions where he was sent on that didn't go as well.
Yeah. That would be very interesting to actually know what happened in those situations. Yeah. And then he goes, please, Clarence, tell me where she is. You're not going to like it, George. Where is she? She's an old maid. She never married. Where's Mary? Where is she? Where is she? She's just about to close up at the library. So, I mean, we talked about this a long time ago when Ma Bailey said that now we're just a bunch of old maids, you know, at the wedding. But they really were a lot older. I wouldn't necessarily say that they're old maids because they were both in their, I think, their late 50s at the time or something like that, which
and
I don't.
Annie certainly won't accept that she's an old maid. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, she says, "Speak for yourself." But the idea though is that Mary was born approximately the same time as Harry, so you know she's maybe 34, 35 at this point.
Right.
Yeah. You know, not much more than that. And to call someone an old lady at that age is an old maid. Is a little strange.
Yeah, it is, and I know that people who criticize this movie, this is one of the things that they will go for, and they're not wrong that it is. You know, it is an extremely dated thing to say and a dated point of view. One could point out that you know Clarence is died 200 years before this movie takes place, so he would have an even more antiquated sense of gender roles.
Yes.
Than the average man from 1945 would have had, but absolutely, it's not, and the depiction of you know what Mary's life is like is problematic, certainly from a modern point of view.
Correct, but I think what they're trying to show here is that Mary so much needed George that he was the only person she would have felt comfortable marrying, and therefore. If George is not around, she's just not going to get married. And, you know, it just happens to be that she's 33 and single, but in the same vein, it could be that she'd be in her 70s and is single. Because what the point they're trying to make here is that there is no George Bailey, so Mary has no one to fall in love with properly. Because the only person for her is George Bailey. And if there is no George Bailey, so she's got to be alone. You know,
absolutely.
I just don't like the way that they interpret it here by saying you're not going to like it. She's an old maid. You know, that type of thing. That's, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's the way that Capra thought at that time. I don't know.
Absolutely. Though apparently, I just learned this from this book that apparently Capra had said that was one of his only regrets about this movie is that he would have, he wished he'd actually made Mary like independent, living on her own. Like, well, it would have been less dramatic because. George, you know, if George didn't like seeing Mary as a strong, independent woman, that would think less highly of George.
Well, she is a strong, independent woman throughout the movie. I mean, she is the backbone of George Bailey.
Oh, Mary's the hero of this movie. In many ways. You know, George is, you know, always upset about his place in the world. Mary is completely comfortable with her place in the world and knows exactly how to make use of it. Yeah.
That's right.
So Mary's, I'm a little sorry that I don't have more scenes with Mary because I think she's such a wonderful character. And oh God, is this a phenomenal performance by Donna Reed. I mean, every performance in this movie is a virtuoso.
Yeah.
But oh boy, is Donna Reed so incredible in this. You know, you hear that Donna Reed said that, she got a lot of letters from some servicemen, and servicemen, of course, write to movie stars. But you write to Lana Turner, you write to Mae West or whoever, and it's like, hey, send me a picture of your legs. But, you know, but she said that the letters that she got were just so heartbreaking because, you know, they saw her much more as a mother figure, much more as a, you know, big sister kind of figure, and they would just pour their hearts out to her. And the thing is, I mean, Donna Reed was as beautiful and glamorous as any other movie star of the time. She probably could have, you know, been, you know, playing, you know, more sort of, you know, sex appeal kind of roles, probably could have been that. But just, you know, could you imagine a better performance by anyone as Mary Bailey than what she brings?
Yeah, she's great here. And, she really is.
Yeah. And, you know, from a 21st century perspective, you know, from a post, you know, a woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle way of looking at things, which, by the way, is my point of view, is an opinion I do share. It's a little hard to take the whole idea of being an old maid and it being a horrifying fate. But this movie asks you to accept angels, asks you to accept a very magical cosmology. So accepting the idea of soulmates is not any more of a leap than that.
Correct. And I think that's the way that people should look at it. The idea that it's just that Mary doesn't have her soulmate, and it's not because of anything else. It's not from a chauvinistic perspective or anything like that. The point here is that, you know, Mary and George are meant to be together. And if there is no George or if there is no Mary, then they'll be searching for someone that's not there.
Right. She's just like half a human being. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, boy, the scene of them both, you know, with their faces together on the phone with Sam and just, you know, realizing, you know, that they're meant to be together is, I mean, I think that's just one of the most remarkable scenes in film history.
Mm-hmm.
And, and, you know, when Sam is saying, you know, this is a, you know, once in a lifetime, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. And then, you know, like, no, Mary is the opportunity of a lifetime,
that's
George.
Right.
And then, you know, and then he's fighting it and he gets it. It's so powerful and so wonderful. And I certainly understand that if that concept of soulmates is hard for people to accept, and, you know, and again, it's not really the way I look at the world, but I think you need to meet a movie on its own terms. And if you can accept, you know, somebody, you know, a superhero flying through the sky, if you can accept, you know, characters breaking out into song in a musical, this is, you know, something you need to accept to meet this movie on its own terms.
Right.
And if you do, you'll have an incredible experience because it's such a masterpiece.
I completely agree with you on that.
Yeah.
And then this minute ends with a shot of Mary closing up the library. And then we see a look on George's face that he's completely shocked. And yeah. People are going to have to come back tomorrow to find out exactly what happens after.
Yeah, I'm sorry I won't be here, but I will say, boy, you know, Pottersville is a pretty awful place, but the library's open awfully late on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
you will give it that. Yeah. And also, the Bailey kids went to school on Christmas Eve? I mean, was that a thing in the 40s that you wouldn't have had Christmas Eve off?
You're talking about the day before. You're not talking about Christmas Eve. You're talking about Christmas, the day before Christmas, or the morning of Christmas Eve.
Morning of Christmas Eve, because Zuzu, you know, comes home from school on December 24th.
That's right.
That's when she, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. comes home and gets to school. So she had school that day.
Yes.
I don't know if that would have been the case.
I believe it was.
Okay. So,
right. You know, I think that it was only Christmas Day that there's no school. Depending on what day of the week it falls out, obviously, but yeah.
Oh boy, the Silent Generation had it rough. Yeah.
That's why they're known as the greatest generation.
Yeah. School on Christmas Eve and libraries open until 11 p.m. on Christmas Eve.
So that you can do your homework.
Maybe it had closed to the public, but she was closing it up. You know, she was, you know, doing whatever, you know, bookkeeping or tidying had to be done before actually leaving for the night.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. So every Wednesday we have a segment called It's a Wonderful Wednesday, where the idea behind this segment is that over the last 78 years since this movie came out, there have been tons of various media that have taken the basic premise of this movie and tried to apply it to themselves. What will happen if something changes in the life of the character, or if the character doesn't exist, or anything like that. So every week I talk about something else. And this week I decided that because you, like me, are a child of the 80s and 90s, why don't I pick a TV show that was around during that time that takes this idea? So we will travel back in time to December 17th, 1989, where there was a two-part episode of Married with Children, which takes this premise to a great perspective. Have you ever seen the episode, It's a Bundyful Life?
I think I have seen it. Am I remembering correctly that it's that Al gets the It's a Wonderful Life treatment, sees what life is, what the world's like without him, and it's better for everybody? Am I right that Peg is married to Jefferson in it?
Yes. Or to, okay. Well, she's married. She's not married to Jefferson. She's married to the actor, you know, who plays Jefferson. But he's not Jefferson here. He's someone else. Ted McGinley, I think his name is. So basically, it's a typical Married with Children episode where he's very upset about the fact that, you know, everyone hates him and it's Christmas and he's supposed to, he needs to go to the bank to take out some money that he put away in order to buy them presents, and it doesn't work. And he gets all depressed and he tries to find different schemes of how he's going to make some more money. And that doesn't work either. And then he ends up going home and everyone's all upset at him because he didn't bring any presents. And then he goes outside to put on the Christmas lights, and like one light goes on, and then he says, "Oh, I'll fix it." And he electrocutes himself. And then he wakes up and he is greeted by his guardian angel, played by Sam Kinison.
Oh, yes, that's definitely ringing a bell.
And,
well, and this would have been right around the same time that the first episode of The Simpsons aired, right?
It wouldn't be right around the same time. It is the same night.
And that has the same plot, that Homer doesn't have the money to buy Christmas presents. At least mm-hmm. we have that element of the plot.
That's right.
Hey, how interesting. The exact same night. That was a historic night of TV.
Yes, it really was. And I mean, I've always loved Sam Kinison. I think he was an amazing comedian. And in the few movies that he was in, you know, he always really stood out, like even in Back to School and here. Because here he does a lot of his screaming also. So that works too. I actually read that Sam Kinison was the original choice to be Al Bundy, but they decided that he was too vulgar and didn't want to give him the role. So,
interesting boy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So,
my only thought is, it's hard for me to imagine Al Bundy with long hair. That's the only objection I would have.
I don't know. Maybe they would have. Maybe they would have asked him to cut it. I don't know. I can't confirm or deny at this point.
But we've got a very different show. Yeah.
Yes, it would have. And the bottom line is that in this version of It's a Wonderful Life, everyone's life is actually much better. With the fact that Al Bundy is not around, and Al Bundy gets upset about this and then asks his guardian angel to, you know, give him back his regular life. And he says to him, why? And he says, well, you know, if I'm going to be miserable, everyone needs to be miserable, or something to that effect. it's a fun version of it. Especially like I said, because Sam Kinison plays the Clarence of the guardian angel, but you know, it's a nice way to do this. And, you know, it was able to give Married with Children a double episode that night.
Right.
So, yeah, I like that.
It's coming back to me now. As I recall, it's still it was still Christina Applegate and David Faustino playing their children, right?
Of course.
Even with a different biological father, they managed to have identical children.
Yes, of course.
Because I remember when Family Guy did something similar, where Peter saw a different world, where Lois was married to what's his name, the ladies' man character.
I'm not that familiar with the Family Man.
I mean, since that's a cartoon, of course they could do this. They drew the children different, so they looked like they were half. They were, you know, half Lois and half the other character. They gave him the big giant chin that he has. Quagmire. That's the character's name. Of course, do that in a cartoon. Married with the Children was a bit of a hit or miss show with me.
Exactly.
That cast, very talented cast, often better than their material.
I still don't think it's a show that translates very well to today's day and age. There are comedies from the 80s that still work, but this is not one of them. It's just not as funny.
Not as much. And
So whatever.
The early days of Fox, when they were all about sort of shock content.
That's right. Exactly. All right. So, Dean, would you like to one last time tell everyone where they can find you?
Thanks. Well, I know I'm. So you can always Google me to find my publishers. PlayScripts handles a bunch of my plays. I'm also have plays published by Hoyer, which is spelled H-E-U-E-R, Publishing, and Brooklyn Publishers, and Youth Plays, and Pioneer Drama. And I guess I'll since we're doing a Christmas movie, I'll plug my Christmas play again, which I plugged on the first episode I did, called Chestnuts Roasted, a collection of five short comedies about the holidays. One of them is called The Holiday Dessert Draft, which is all about how every holiday chose its signature dessert and how Christmas somehow got stuck with candy canes and fruitcake, while other holidays of perhaps lower profiles got much tastier desserts. And then there's inevitably a Christmas Carol parody in there, and a Christmas Story parody, which I wrote during COVID. So it's about it's about looking back on Christmas 2020 from the distant future. And then there's a Charlie Brown riff and a film noir parody about Santa's reindeer called The Big Sleigh.
All right, very cool. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, Dean, thank you very much for joining me this 5 days. It's been a great conversation. And I really enjoyed having you on. And I'm glad that I was able to give you the opportunity to talk about one of your favorite movies, which is also one of mine.
I'm so glad, too. I'm really glad for the opportunity. Thank you so much. I hope everybody has enjoyed this. I know we had a lot to say.
Yes. All right. Great. So I will be back tomorrow with a new guest. But until then, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.